Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 123, where Rowan, Tom, and Sarah are discussing an article from the field of economic sociology, Neil Flickstein's Markets as Politics, A Political-Cultural Approach to Market Institutions, published in the American Sociological Review in 1996. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. Well, in part one, we started tackling the article. We made it about roughly two-thirds of the way through. And that's because we did have quite a lot to discuss in the first half. So we're now going to go ahead and pick up the rest. This is from the section of the problem of change and stability of markets, which is kind of basically dominates the latter half of the article and provides most of the propositions that I think we'll find interesting as to how well they really reflect reality, especially, you know, in 30 years now following the writing of this article. So what I'd like to do is just recap where we left off. And the section begins with, there are three phases in market formation, emergence, stability, and crisis. And so now what we're talking about here, the problem of change and stability of markets, we're really looking at the life cycle of markets. How do they form? How do they mature? How do they die? And the whole bunch of the propositions in this section kind of relate to some part of the life cycle and the relationship between the firms and the state and whatever. We'll get into greater detail. This is where Sarah mentioned about the definition of the stable market as defined as a market in which the identities and status hierarchy of firms are well known and a conception of control that guides actors who leads firms is shared. What followed is a statement that politics will reproduce the position of the advantaged groups. It's kind of left perhaps to the imagination of what we mean by advantaged, because he's talking about incumbent firms and challenger firms as being in the competition. Now, there's obviously competition among all of the firms, but he's really focused on the competition between incumbent firms. Those firms that are established, entrenched, have the benefits, and therefore I suppose we can consider to be advantaged. And then challenger groups, who are the disruptors, the innovators, new competitors on the market, trying to get their part of the share. So with that, I think we are in a position to start moving towards addressing and perhaps critiquing some of the propositions that came out in this section.
But just to follow on that, to say that it's not entirely out of nowhere, this privileged groups, because back in the section on state building as market building, 660, he does claim that laws are never neutral. They favor certain groups of firms. So that is one of the pieces that contributes to this privilege or this position of competitive advantage. And that's something that I think, again, you've given us a historical context of, we had this chance to remake capitalism. We had this chance to remake the modern democracy. And the firms that got in first or the firms that got in strongest got to change the rules of the game or make the rules of the game, right? As much as we had a chance to rebuild, we didn't. We just replicated in a lot of places. And I just was really always struck by such a short section that's not even introduced in the section on law as an institution. So I think it's not as much of a, oh, I wonder what he means by that. Shall we unpack privilege in our current understanding of privilege? No, it's talking about it. It's the first time his conception as politics actually shows itself and makes sense. He's talking about power dynamics, right?
Yeah, so I agree with you that there's definitely, you do see this part of his analysis coming based on some of the groundwork he lays down in the prior sections. And then you also come across some of the perhaps similar issues that we might have discussed in part one, where if I start with proposition five itself, which is the first one in this section, he says, at the beginning of a new market, the largest firms are the most likely to be able to create a conception of control and a political coalition to control competition. Again, not sure how this tracks with, you know, disruption from the outside, or if I think about the current market for chatbots and LLMs, you know, OpenAI might have not have been the largest, and you know, Google was the largest perhaps working on this, but arguably they're the ones who ended up creating a conception of what these chatbots look like, how quickly you go to market, how much you care about safety, etc., and other, and how the firm is structured, how business partnerships are held, how investments are brought in, so on and so forth, rather than Google, because they were the challengers, not the incumbents, but they're the ones who had the successful product. And so it's not so much the size as it was, in this case, the clout, perhaps. So yeah, some of these propositions, again, I'm not sure how strongly I would buy them. Similarly, proposition six, while I'm at it, it talks about how power struggles within firms are over who can solve the problem of how to best organize the firm to deal with competition. I'm not sure about the face validity there, where power struggles are about who can best organize the firm. Earlier in the paper, he talks about how power struggles might manifest that way. And I can see that, where the way to get power is to convince others that you have the best conception of how to organize the firm. But the power struggle itself could just be over power and nothing else. And so the proposition laid out in a way to say that power struggles are, and definitively, he's not saying that's often over or sometimes over. He just says power struggles within firms are over who can solve the problem of how to organize the firm best.
It's interesting because propositions five and six were the two that I had the least trouble with in this section. But I think it does kind of ask the question of when and how, you know, the definition of what is incumbent and what is challenging. Because when I read that and when I was thinking about AI, I was kind of thinking about perhaps OpenAI, and I don't know all of the background about the AI, the history of the AI firms and who emerged when, but like OpenAI became the very, very rapid incumbent. Like this is a capability in a market that was so novel that it really was the largest firm creating its own conception of control and the one that everybody was replicating off of. The idea of it becoming a challenger to another market or to incumbents in another market came, I think, only after there was the push or the desire or the opportunity to integrate AI into other things, which then made this a challenge to the Googles, the others, or whatever. This does get into the construct issue of how are we defining what is incumbent or challenger at any given time.
And also one can think of maybe the phenomenal realm or like what was happening empirically in the 20th century versus now, where maybe while writing this, the author is thinking of big companies. So let's say a new market is plastics and DuPont gets to decide the conception of control in plastics because DuPont has already been an incumbent in all markets or a larger category, and you have these large diversified firms, GE and others, in which case you don't need to make this distinction because then the assertion is that that large firm will decide how that new marketplace works. Innovation R&D is bringing out this new marketplace, but it will be, to bring it to the AI example, it will be Google who will of course decide how it works. And so if that's what he had in mind, then it's no longer the case with OpenAI. But I can also see your reading, Tom, where it's a new market. And so the largest in that new market is OpenAI. And so then by definition, but I have a sense he was thinking more of, you know, if plastics is the new market and DuPont is immediately going to, you know, decide the rules of the game.
Then I'd like to ask, to lean on your expertise here, what about state-sponsored industries or state-supported industries, particularly in the historical context of this article, but also if we're using this part of the episode to talk more about modern. Let's think about solar panels and solar vehicles out of China at the moment, right? We're talking about January 2025 when we say at the moment. So when you're talking about politics and institutions are supporting markets, what happens in that case when the state is itself a corporate actor?
I think, and that we can even see by, let's say, bridging the first and second sections of the propositions or set of propositions in this paper, where in the first bit he talks about how states will push almost a set of institutions that then create like a cultural template that gets adopted. And so if it starts from there, and then if you have a large incumbent who might or might not be state-owned, but is likely to still be downstream of the state's market building. And the way he set it up, again, as we discussed in part one, because of not necessarily paying too much attention to reverse causality or kind of chains of things, the argument here would be that, yeah, the state would drive what those firms do. And if the state owns the firm, then even more so, the certain rules of exchange, etc., will creep in.
I agree. And I think this raises a really interesting question about the differences between goods and services here. Because in the case of goods, and we go back to the market institutions that we're talking about here, property rights. In terms of goods, property rights, I'm thinking intellectual property, I'm thinking patents, I'm thinking copyrights, I'm thinking, you know, a lot of tangible ownership. And when the state owns that, then the state has assumes a lot of responsibilities for those things, which tend to be very weak to enforce because it takes a lot of resources to do it, whereas corporations may be better suited. And so corporations, property rights, you know, who has claims on ownership of things becomes really central to how markets to how corporations compete. So then in the case of products, you can see how these market institutions, the state becomes not just a regulator, but a direct competitor. The concern then becomes, is the state putting controls, restricting the ability to sell or buy or whatever in ways that prevent the best goods from being put onto the market? That's usually the charge. When it comes to services, it's almost the other way around. There, let's take medicine, for example. Society, by and large, gross overstatement, does tend to value some degree of equality of access, or medical services are not the sort of thing that we like having totally onto the marketplace because of the inequities it might produce. And so the states owning that is perhaps a different calculus. The governance structures, the laws are written for equality, rules of exchange, conceptions of control. There's a sense of we want to make sure that the access is available to everybody. And so there's a different thought process in terms of how acceptable those are. And of course, it's not the same for all types of services either. I mean, it varies. But you kind of see that the context sort of depends on what the society considers to be desired or valuable in terms of what they considered acceptable, putting things in the hands of the private sector versus the public sector, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think in this paper and in the author's conception, the primacy of the state shows up even here in Proposition 7, which is where he says, through intended and unintended actions, states can thwart the actions of firms to create stable conceptions of control. So not just that their conception of control might be influenced by the state, which was Sarah's earlier point, but that if they're trying to do something else, the states can choose to thwart that or to kind of reconfigure it based on changing the laws, changing the regulations. And like you said, in some cases you might want it, such as food safety, drugs, etc. And in other cases, maybe, I don't know, internet or content companies, etc., maybe, or journalism, you might not want it as much.
But also one of the pieces that he talks about from the very beginning is a fascination, let's call it, with price. It's really important that they're able to compete on price. Prices, and I would take from the literature a signal, right? We confuse price with quality, or we often use it as a proxy for quality, but it's very important that they're able to compete fairly on price. And that's where the section on anti-cartels and collusion, antitrust, competition, anti-cartel laws comes in. But I thought we would talk a bit more about features, right? And that's where Tom's interest in services can come back as well. And the differentiation part of innovation can come back. And that's also, I guess, with our links to our other episodes, where the institutional isomorphism can come back into discussion as well, which is, if we wanted to say that, okay, prices are now fair, and we're sure that we have mechanisms to ensure that there's no funny business going on, then the incentive should be in feature, right? In differentiation of features. And he talks earlier about places where that will never happen. So he specifically, on page 659, talks about restaurants and barbershops, right? Like, these are two that he just is like, this is never going to change from there. These classically competitive markets, as he calls them. Stability has never emerged. Okay, so let's talk in the more modern framing. Let's talk in the service framing. Let's talk about these companies that we've just been talking about and say, why don't we have more differentiation with this lens on it? Or what would a markets as politics metaphor encourage us to think of in terms of more differentiation?
So a market as politics metaphor ultimately says that the kind of the model of action, to use his phrase, is towards stability, which in this conception is to try your best to avoid price competition. One way to do that is through differentiation. So we're not undercutting each other. I'm just doing something different. And so then the natural logic will be, we don't see differentiation. There must be other ways through which they are avoiding price competition. Now, whether that is implicit collusion or regulatory capture or what have you, the market as politics would just tell us to investigate how else, if not through differentiation, how else are they avoiding price competition and seeking stability?
Yeah, when I'm thinking about differentiation, and I'm going to use barbershop as an example of the different ways in which what is an easily defined, very simple service that you really can't put a lot of bells and whistles on, but we do put a lot of bells and whistles on. And then what happens is that at some point you've got an intersection of different barbershops are trying to cater to particular clientele, or it's a matter of access or a matter of reliability. Like, why would you have large barbershop chains? Because if you have clientele who are moving about the country, they want to be able to go into a barbershop that they at least can count on service, even if the service is actually lower quality than the corner barbershop in the middle of downtown. So you have chains and all that sort of thing. It's at some point then that internal firm-to-firm competition of, say, you know, big corporation against small corner barbershop, et cetera, you have patterns of behavior that emerge where the experience of going into one is vastly different than going into the other. And the only times in which you would see states jumping in would be if you had something happen where, I can't think of an example in barbershop, but like, for example, with food safety, you have to have recalls or stuff like that. What if there was something that happening where disease is spreading through a barbershop?
An interesting historical interjection here in the UK, the original surgeons were barbers and they used to work in the barbershop. So there's a differentiated value add. They'll do some bloodletting for you or an amputation even alongside a haircut. It's speaking of how these things persist in the NHS today, if you are a surgeon who's cleared their exam called the FRCS, you're now a fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons, you go from being called doctor, which you were called when you were junior before the exams, to being called Mr. or Miss, because historically they were separate from the medics and they were barbers.
Very interesting. Thanks.
Well, hang on. Okay, so let's take this to its absolute in extremis. I don't think there are state-owned or state-sponsored barbershops and state-owned or state-sponsored restaurants. So
you would be wrong.
Am I? Oh, do tell.
Okay. State-sponsored is probably not the right way to put it, but militaries run their own barbershops through the post-exchange systems. they do that for access. Post-exchange systems are used to provide routine health and welfare services for military personnel in combat situations. But in order for it to be viable, there has to be a peacetime level of operation that ensures that the capacity is provided. And it's not confined to just the U.S. Every military, for example, has its own version of that. And it's why there tends to be exchange services, which is basically a department store or commissaries, which are groceries that are government run. And the question about the competition for access and between the public and private sectors become very big in this, because there is always a lingering question on, in peacetime, are these operations taking customers away from the private sector? So that's an example of a state sponsored that I can come up with.
Robin, would you like to continue with the explanation of the second half of the propositions, or what you wanted us to continue discussing in this latter phase? Because I think we covered the first three of section two.
I just want to give a special shout out to Proposition 10, which goes, in markets with stable conceptions of control, there's a great deal of agreement by market participants on the conception of control. Which is just true by definition, as far as I'm concerned. You're saying that, yeah, it's like saying in markets with stable price, there's great agreement among participants on the price. Or to abstract out ad absurdum, or whatever the Latin phrase would be, if X is stable, then there's agreement on X. I don't think we needed to add to the proposition count by introducing Proposition 10.
Let me offer another view. Because for that reason, I thought maybe that was the case in the post-Cold War era. But I think it's actually interesting to think about, what do we mean by price now? Because there is the aspect of the cash that's being transacted, but there's also kind of like a social price, if you will. Maybe we're paying attention more to than we were in the 1990s, because even when the prices are the same, they're not. If I like a particular make of car, or if I like a particular something or other, that when all things are equal, I'm going to gravitate towards what I'm familiar with as a customer. And I wonder if the word agreement is perhaps where I'm stuck on, because it's not, maybe agreement was too strong. Maybe it's just we compete for different values, or compete on different, apart from price, in order to maintain market dominance. So I tripped on agreement with that, because I don't think it's necessarily agreement. I think the institutionalization of a price, however temporary, is still just a pattern of behavior, not necessarily intentional. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I guess in that case, I could see the word agreement being kind of used in two ways, and then it's not clear, of course, in this phrasing, which one is meant. But one is agreement in terms of people just agree that this is the conception of control, or this is the price. The other way of to use the word agreement is they agree with the with that, like they like it. They are in agreement with that particular conception of control. This is how things should work as well. Or if I use the price example, they agree that this is what the price should be. If he means the latter, then perhaps that is a debatable proposition and something to sink our teeth into, which is, if there's a stable conception of control, does everyone tend to agree that that should be the conception of control? But my reading was the more, I guess, simplistic one of like, if there's a stable conception of control, everyone agrees that that is the conception of control, which for me is true by definition.
Fair enough. So now that we've unpacked that proposition, which other ones do we think we totally accept that maybe we don't? Go ahead, Sarah.
So one that I don't necessarily accept, and it's quite short. So to be fair to the author, there isn't a lot of space for him to convince me or for us to engage, is 11. Incumbent firms pay attention to the actions of other incumbent firms, not challenger firms, while challenger firms focus on incumbent behavior. So I accept the second half. Challengers clearly need to focus on what incumbents are doing, because that's their reference point and that's what they're trying to, you know, solve for X in a situation of Y. Unless potentially, I think one separate or caveat to that could be something like incubators, right? Which are very aware of what the others are doing and other sort of entrepreneurial situations. So if I accept the second half, then it's only my first half, which is that incumbents pay attention to other incumbents. And I would say that has to vary with the maturity of the industry, with where the opportunities for innovation are. So I'm currently engaged in a book called Material World about the six core items that shape everything that the world is currently built on. So sand and glass and concrete. And there's a chapter in that about the silicon chip race that I'm very interested in. And the chapter has really helped me understand that it's not actually about chip versus chip. And it's not even chip science versus chip manufacturing. It's every single part of the supply chain, from raw materials to the sort of pinball machine across the globe of processing. And I would say that at no point there are they talking about what incumbent A and incumbent B are doing against each other. They're well aware of what they're doing. They're paying attention to the challenger and they're paying attention to their suppliers and the problems with their suppliers. And there's only one paragraph that supports that whole proposition. And it says, a stable world depends on social relations between the largest firms. The central players will generally ignore challenger organizations under most circumstances because they pose little threat to the overall stability of the market. And back to our discussion of a few minutes ago about goods versus services. I think goods versus services has a lot to say to this one as well. And given the sort of imbalance in supporting evidence or supporting argumentation across the different propositions, I think that's one that I definitely feel is less defensible.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I don't think I caught that on my first reading, but there's two elements of it. And again, these are maybe emblematic of the critiques we've had in general, but one is the wording is unnecessary. So he says incumbent firms pay attention to the actions of other incumbent firms, not challenger firms. Why be so categorical? Like, if anything, you might say that they pay more attention to incumbents than to challengers. And you can still try the same argument, although I agree with you that there are issues with the argument. But why even be so categorical that they don't pay attention, in your wording of the proposition, that they don't pay attention to challenger firms? And then, yeah, coming to your point, Sarah, about his supporting argument itself, like, so saying that central players, okay, so we get that the whole ethos is that people are focusing on stability, and so then what they need to pay attention to is what is a threat to stability, but then it doesn't follow that incumbents are the threat to stability and not challengers. If anything, what we know from, for example, institutional theory, which he draws upon, is that incumbents have already kind of followed an isomorphic pattern. So everyone has found a stable spot. And so your threat to stability is more likely to be a challenger than an incumbent. And so using kind of the theories that he's drawing on itself, I think that logic doesn't really follow and the proposition doesn't necessarily fit.
Those are all excellent critiques. I think this is one which perhaps maybe it was a product of its time, because at the time, how capable were challenger firms to be so disruptive so routinely as they became, say, in, you know, more of the digital era nowadays, where a challenger can really disrupt very quickly, very powerfully an existing market. So I wholly agree. I think this was one of those that perhaps was a little bit too 1990s-ish and probably was even becoming less true at that time, because that was when the internet was coming to be.
And I mean, even before, it was already kind of surprising to write something like that in the 90s, because regardless of internet, you had been through the challengers from Japan in multiple industries. And so to still say that the central players will generally ignore challengers because they pose little threat to the stability of the market, you've already kind of seen that that's not the case.
This is perhaps a case of an incumbent idea not recognizing the challenger ideas. Are there any other propositions we want to torch?
Okay, let's do a couple more, but just make a note for like putting the little Rowan on my shoulder would say proposition 13 is also not controversial. So what are we provoking, or what are we testing, or what is clear here. I will tee you up and say, I think I've understood your position correctly with that.
Yeah, exactly. Some of them seems to be propositional padding. Maybe if that was a thing back in those days, I don't know.
Well, I think I think you have to go into the text to, because he unpacked it in the text. Three types of events. This is market crisis is observed when incumbent organizations begin to fail, caused by three kinds of events: decrease in demand, invasion by other firms, and the state can intentionally or unintentionally undermine the market by changing rules. I think that those are three good examples. It's kind of interesting because the paragraph that followed just seemed like it actually was a separate topic that he brought in. Incumbents rarely become innovators because they are busy defending the status quo. Market transformation is precipitated by invaders. While that may be partially true, I wonder to what extent now incumbents are actually driving a lot more innovation than perhaps than maybe at the time in which this was written. Management of innovation is different because now the expectation is for products and services that new is better. The new next great thing is better. So any firm that stands still is going to be, at risk or in trouble, however you want to put it. So I think that that has not stood up well in time.
Yeah, it is interesting to think about the contextualizing it. And I agree with you, Tom. Like, whereas Proposition 10 was almost purely tautological or true by definition, and even the explanation was just simply repeating that, Proposition 13, true by definition, but then just add some coloring and flavors to it by giving us those three sources of failure and crisis. To your point about the incumbents becoming innovators, it's interesting to think that around that time was also when I think in the late 90s, when Clayton Christensen was publishing first his papers and later the book on the innovator's dilemma and this idea of creative disruption and how incumbents are normally swept away. We had kind of foundational innovation management work. I'm thinking of Abernathy and Utterback, who talk about how there's this kind of fossilization and stasis as you go further around along the innovation cycle. You go from radical to just doing incremental innovation. So it comes from all of that. And like you said, we have seen a change in the phenomenon itself where people are innovating a lot more rapidly. There's been a lot of research on experimenting and taking experimental approaches within organizations. And so I think all of that has come in more in the 21st century than when this was written. And acquisitions, right? People innovate also through acquisition. And that, if anything, similarly involves looking not just at incumbents, but paying attention to challengers and then buying them up. So it is a different time in that sense.
I'm internally conflicted, which is ironic when you hear the text of this proposition, about Proposition 16. So it says, when firms begin to fail, the intra-organizational power struggle heats up, leading to higher turnover of top personnel and greater activism by boards of directors and non-management shareholders. New sets of organizational actors attempt to reconstruct the firm along the lines of the invaders. So the development under the proposal is by and large factual. I don't think I have anything specific that I would disagree with in the development. And there's an interesting set of questions where he says, what crisis makes this conception of control no longer viable for large corporations? And what is the new conception of control and who are its proponents? Okay, but this is one of those things where you're situated as faculty in a business school and you're saying, if I buy everything you're saying, then what you're telling me is the reality runs completely counter to what we teach our students in business school, right? Because we're teaching them that is the worst time to make these kinds of changes, to let a civil war happen. If you take a family lens on it to allow family infighting, right? It's a time for unity. It's a time for, there's the key word of this paper, stability. So this is one of those things where people often criticize us for being out of touch with reality, is that this is what the theory and the principle would say. And all of the examples that he pulls as support are ones that we nod along and agree with. But I wonder, when we come to it, Tom, if you would put the historical lens on this again and say, if you had to update this article or update this specific section with what we've known in the last 30 years, would you think this proposition still holds, or would you think this is the proposition that we go out on, or is it the first opportunity for revision?
You spurred a thought. Are these propositions descriptive or prescriptive? Because some of them seem to be descriptive, which is to say this is what happens, whether or not it should or not. And then the prescriptive is, well, say, you know, if we were in the position of consulting, this is what we would advise leaders. And I would agree with you. This is a case where I think it's a very firmly descriptive, because you're absolutely right. This type of crisis is usually the wrong time to start kicking up dust. Although sometimes it's ideal to kick up dust. It's very, you know, contingency based. But some of the other propositions sounded a little bit more prescriptive, like a provocation to say that this is what we expect to happen, what we should expect, what we should do. I didn't detect a lot of, there was some inconsistency, I think, along those lines.
But yeah, this one, I agree with you, Tom, is definitely comes across as a descriptive one of this is what tends to happen when a firm fails. There'll be this power struggle based on conception of control. In fact, it reminded me of the episode from, I think it was a year ago, perhaps two at this point, where the OpenAI board had tried to oust the CEO. So there was kind of a failure moment, let's say, in the operation of the firm. And then you had essentially in there was this conception of control about how we are structured and do we have nonprofits and researchers on our board or not. Eventually there was a competing vision, which is what has come true, which is you have now people like Larry Summers and others on the board rather than AI researchers as such, who have now introduced a new conception of control for OpenAI. And so the idea that the battles happen along those lines makes sense to me, and that failure is a particularly sensitive point where the conception of control is up for grabs or up for contestation, let's say, also makes sense to me.
Yeah, thanks. And, you know, we're kind of coming close on time. You know, most of the time when we have these episodes, we usually read the article and discuss it somewhat in reverence because of its position in the literature and whatnot. I think it's fair to say we probably have taken a much more critical lens on this reading than others. And I guess maybe as a way of wrapping up, why do we think that is? What is it about this work that has provoked us in ways we might not be accustomed to on this program?
So one thing I think ties into what we were discussing in the beginning of part one, which is it is just a different style of writing. It's something between an essay and someone's musings and provocations and an AMR style with propositions at the same time. Some propositions are more fully fleshed out, others aren't, but they're all listed as a flat set of propositions. And so it's a lot to do with who's reading the article and what kind of toolkits and conceptions they are coming to it from. And like I said, because I've read other works of his, especially some of his famous work on the transformation of corporate control and some of his empirical stuff, and I didn't have as many qualms with those as I did with this particular piece. So some of it is to do with the style of the piece and this particular one.
As I said in the introduction, I didn't intend, expect, realize the reaction that I would have. I really thought that this was just one more piece in the canon of economic sociology that I needed to help realize my maturity into an institutional scholar. And certainly from the first few pages, I thought that's what was happening. I think if we take it at the level of the writing, I think one thing that I would like more is more organizational examples, like the ones that Rowan's brought up already. So talking about Dow, talking about GM, talking about even a water company, right? You know, a water utility provider, or Con Ed, which was big at the time, and the collapse of Con Ed was big. AT&T was the corporate example for everything. I think I would have found my footing with it a bit better with more examples and a greater variety of examples. I've struggled to understand, as I said, what is the problem that this is solving? And how could I use the markets as politics metaphor in what I'm doing? So I think that's why I didn't embrace it as uncritically as I thought I might. I am perfectly open to, like, an Iron Cage revisited relation to the original Iron Cage metaphor. Perhaps we need a markets as politics revisited in relation to this anchor metaphor. And then if I were able to engage with this a second time with a comparator text or a designated critical text, then perhaps I wouldn't have sounded as combative as perhaps maybe by the end of this episode you think we are. We are not. We are reverential, we are scholarly, we are critical and contextually engaged.
And I would agree. I think that 30 years, a 30-year visit of revisit of these propositions or provocations is in order.
Also, to bring in a positive note, there was one particular paragraph in the paper that stood out to me as actually a beautiful expression of his ultimate aim in this paper, or of his sociology of markets, let's say, and his approach to what it means, what a sociological approach to markets means. And this was in the model of action section. So this is page 659, where he says, market actors live in murky worlds where it is never clear which actions will have which consequences. Yet, actors must construct an account of the world that interprets the murkiness, motivates and determines courses of action, and justifies the action decided upon. In markets, the goal of action is to ensure the survival of the firm. No actor can determine which behaviors will maximize profits, either a priori or post hoc, and action is therefore directed toward the creation of stable worlds. I thought that was just a nice, succinct encapsulation of generally a sociological approach, which is, you know, information is incomplete, actors live in murky worlds, they have to create a conception of the world, and also his specific take on the sociological approach, which is that in lieu of kind of perfect information and profit maximization, you just try for survival and you just try for stability.
That's so good. I love that. And you didn't even know you were going to say that. That's one of the best things.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.